rather unusual situation which is not covered by the committee rules. But in view of the fact that Bob Chandler is a member of Subcommittee 1 and has participated in all the matters that we'll be considering today, I would like to have the commission take action upon his request. I received a letter from Bob Chandler in which he advised us that it was impossible for him to be here today since he had a previous commitment, seems to me, in the Midwest or someplace. But in any event, he explained that his vote on the matters that will be considered here today was the same as that of Senator John Burns, and he has given John Burns his proxy to vote today in connection with these items, informing us that his vote would be the same since he has gone over them. And we don't have any rule as to whether or not proxy can be accepted for voting at meetings before the whole commission. What is your feeling on that?
I would think, Mr. Chairman, while it wouldn't be wise to lay down a general rule, that because Chandler has taken an active part in the subcommittee meetings, at least as I read the minutes he has, and joins intensively in the discussion and so on, under those circumstances, that it would be appropriate to permit the proxy in this instance without in any way creating a precedent that you can automatically have one. Because it seems to me the full commission is entitled to views of all of its members. I would be reluctant to make it a general sort of situation. I would move, Mr. Chairman, to permit the proxy to be exercised during this day and tomorrow.
You've heard the motion. Is there a second? Under discussion, my sentiments are exactly those of Judge Burns's. It isn't as though we're acting upon someone who has not participated and is not aware of what is going on, because his vote on each of the items that will be considered has been the same as that of John Burns. And the views that he's expressed, as you'll see in the minutes, are substantially the same. And the net effect of it actually is that it will be his own vote that is being cast. Now, aside from that, we may have a problem with the quorum. I guess not. How many are there on our commission? 13.
And counting the proxy.
7, counting the proxy. There'll be two more.
Thornton's here.
Yeah, Thornton and Elder Mahoney. Is there any further discussion? If not, then the motion is for this particular meeting, today and tomorrow, that the proxy of Bob Chandler given to John Burns may be exercised by the latter. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. I presume that all of you have read the minutes of the meeting of July 19th. Is there any necessity to have them read aloud at the present time? You've heard the motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Justice Sloan, you had an opportunity, and George, you've read them, no doubt, I think.
Okay.
All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. I think everyone in this room realizes the length of time that has been devoted by Subcommittee Number 1 to the robbery, arson, and forgery and related offenses, the preliminary drafts of which Numbers 3, 4, and 2 we will be acting upon today. And I merely want to take this opportunity to thank John Burns and the members of his committee, not only for the time that they have devoted to each of these matters, but also to the depth that they have explored the items that are concerned. I think they have done a remarkable job. I've attended a few of the subcommittee meetings, and I really regret that members of the public are not present, so that they can appreciate the extent of the discussion and the closeness of the scrutiny and examination that is given to the problems that arise in relation to each one of these matters. I think that Professor Platt and Justice Sloan and others who are present can testify to the fact that perhaps this subcommittee is giving as thorough consideration to all aspects of these problems as could be given and as has been given by any other commission that has undertaken the criminal law revision in the past. So with that compliment to Senator John Burns, you may take over and you will proceed.
I'm almost tempted to say thank you, Mr. President.
Next year, you will be sitting clear across the hall from
me. Thank you, Tony. You know, I read the minutes of the July 19th meeting and observed where I had said some complimentary things about the subcommittee number one. And of course, you all know what my
wisdom stricken.
No, you know what my feeling is. Well, since Ed Eller and Bruce Spalding are both absent today, I want to start by just telling a very brief phenomenon that has occurred in this subcommittee that relates to both of them. Ed Eller, as you know, is a former sheriff of Lane County and had a reputation in the legislature as being very, very law enforcement prone and narrow-minded, as some people thought, with respect to law enforcement matters. And Bruce Spalding has a reputation of being the premier criminal defense lawyer in the state of Oregon, and some people said when he was appointed to this commission that he'd be 100% defense-oriented. But the funny thing, in working so very closely over these many, many months with these two men, I find that almost the inverse has occurred. Time and time again, Ed Eller, who is asking questions about from a defense-oriented point of view, and Bruce is asking questions and raising points that others haven't raised insofar as prosecution is concerned. So I think that we have a very, very well-balanced committee, and they've done a terrific job, and it goes without saying that Don, Gled, and Mildred certainly have, too. Now, at our full commission meeting on July 19th, we brought before you robbery, and if you will refer yourselves to the minutes of that meeting toward the end of the minutes. You will see where this, it would be on well, actually, starting on page 14 of the minutes of July 19th. It's the black book for those of you that have the binder, dated July 19th. And I don't know where they are in the loose leaf books. But in any event, we submitted at that meeting for your consideration preliminary draft number 2 for robbery. The commission considered it, and you re-referred it back to our subcommittee for further consideration. Frankly, I'm glad that you did. We reconsidered it and are now submitting for your consideration robbery preliminary draft number 3. Now, I'm not sure, Mildred, do all the members of the full commission have the little blue binders that the subcommittee members do?
They're sent out.
All right. Well, in any event, on pages 17 and 18, of the July 19th minutes, we have the reasons why you sent robbery back to us. I won't go over the reasons, you probably read them. If you'll look at book number 13, if you have it, you'll see the preliminary draft number 3 that we worked on following the meeting, and book number H are the the book of minutes where we reconsidered robbery and adopted it. Now, that's what we're submitting here. And what we did basically, and correct me, Don, if I am wrong, I'm not going to read the statutes in its entirety, because I think the last meeting went much, much smoother where we did it section by section without reading it. But what we've done now is we've made robbery into 3 degrees. Robbery in the third degree, which was basically the robbery that we had considered before in the second degree. And this is basically unarmed robbery. Then we inserted a robbery in the second degree, which would take care of the toy pistol situation. Is this not right, Don?
Yes.
And it covers a situation where someone threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon by a verbal, written, or other representation. And then we narrowed robbery in the first degree somewhat. But basically, it's the same as robbery in the second degree, or robbery in the first degree formerly was. I call your attention I think the way to do it, Mr. Chairman, is probably to go section by section. The basic changes are in 2 and 3. But comparing this draft, robbery in the third degree, it's exactly as robbery in the second degree was on the July 19th draft. So the changes are in the next 2 sections. I think we're ready for a motion with respect to robbery in the second degree. There isn't any objection. The third degree, right.
Yeah, that wasn't changed at all, Mr. Chairman. Except that we renumbered it, made it robbery in the third degree, and it appears as section 1 in the draft today. So, as the commentary indicates, it's the same as it would have been second degree in preliminary draft 2.
George, I have a general drafting question that concerns us all in all subcommittee work, and this doesn't go to any specific criticism or in any way. Meant to focus on this particular draft, but let me ask this question. We have a form of prescribing the degree which eventually will be tied to the penalty. In other words, robbery of the first, third degree. Mm-hmm. This is one way that it can be done, and of course the other way it can be done is the way the Model Penal Code has done it, and that is to prescribe the crime, the elements which constitute a felony of the first, second, or third degree, rather than specifying for each crime that it is a robbery, specifically robbery first, second, or third degree. What I'm getting at is that to be the drafting policy of the commission, so that we can all be working on the same general plan in the subcommittees. And if it is, and I have no objection, I'm just raising the general question. If it is, then I would make a specific suggestion here, Don. I'm sure perhaps you thought of this. If you say define robbery in the third degree, then it seems to me that there's going to have to be another sentence added to all of these degree subsections, because robbery in the third degree will not be subject directly to the penalty provisions of the code, no matter what the general section on penalties may be, because there will not be such a thing as penalty for robbery in the first, second, or third degree. It will be a penalty for Class A, Class B, and Class C felonies. Therefore, there's a little cog that's missing. I think what would have to be done, if this is going to be the pattern, is that at the end of Section 1, we're going to have to say robbery in the third degree is a Class A or B or C felony. Otherwise, you don't translate to the necessarily, you have to translate back to your general provision for penalty assessment.
That's well taken. I think you're absolutely right. Don, did you contemplate that?
Yes, and if you'll recall, when we first began the drafting process in Subcommittee Number 1, our very early drafts included a section in which we indicated theft is a blank, or unauthorized use of a vehicle is a blank, and leaving it, contemplating the fact that each section would have to be classified and the blanks would later have to be filled in. And as we went along, we eliminated that in the drafting process, although we were quite aware that we're going to need it. But rather than just putting in a section and leaving it blank, we contemplated we would go back through and add the entire section, or the entire subsection, to each one of these sections as we are classifying them later on. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that answers my question. My general question is: the commission satisfied with this approach? And if so, I assume then that all the subcommittees, the reporters and the subcommittees, will proceed on this basis. I don't think there's been a formal adoption of this particular approach, has there?
This has not been formally acted upon by the commission.
It's the last thing I want to do is cause a technical drafting hassle, but I think it's something that ought to be settled, especially now that we're dealing more and more with specific crimes. The subcommittee with which I've been working, dealing in responsibility, that isn't dealing with the problem at all now. And that's what I suppose because I haven't been focusing on it myself. The problem arises as I now begin to work on a specific crime section, notably homicide. I know that Michigan and New York follow this particular system. Illinois has a very peculiar and I think a bad system in that it assesses a penalty in each section. There is no general penalty provision. The other choice, I suppose, would be the Model Penal Code. If we feel that we're, by practice, so far into the drafts now in the subcommittees, it would be useless to go back and redraft, and I'm quite satisfied to keep going this way.
Do we have to make that decision now, Don?
Well, it's. I think it's a matter that should be formally acted upon. I suppose that now is as good a time as any. And I feel that the draftsmen thus far have pretty much assumed that we were going to grade this along the lines of the New York.
I thought it had been done, but apparently we haven't.
The New York approach. So, for example, I was just looking at our first draft of when we were still calling it grand larceny. We had grand larceny in the third degree as a blank, grand larceny in the second degree as a blank. And contemplated we were later going to designate whether it's a felony in the third degree or whatever happens to be the grading system in the commission document.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you feel that it would be in order, I'd be willing to move that the commission adopt a policy here empowering our reporters or draftsmen or the legislative council at such time as we prepare these to insert an additional sentence onto each specific crime classification indicating that, for example, robbery in third degree is a class blank felony or misdemeanor, what it may be. So I'd be willing to make that motion. Perhaps Professor Platt could frame it in more articulate language.
I don't think
there's a
bothering me if we're going to put this in every statute, though, isn't there another way we can let it yours?
Well, any place we call something first, second, or third?
I agree with John. I don't think we need to insert the sentence now, but I suppose the point that I'm raising is the form of the draft. Mm-hmm. It makes a big difference, of course, whether we follow the model penal code form or whether we follow the form that we're sort of tending to use. It makes a big difference in the actual language of the draft, and there's no point in it, I don't think, in having two conflicting policies, which actually this serves the end that the model penal code seeks to reach. And I'm quite satisfied with it. I think it ought to be formalized just as a formal drafting matter so that there won't be any diversity of drafts, which will necessitate later on a lot of technical redrafting.
John, would it be satisfactory with you if Don were to prepare a draft of the language and will act on it at our next meeting and adopt it as a policy?
I think that would be fine.
Would that be all right with you, Jordan?
In the meantime, we can continue to assume that for the purposes of drafting at this stage, we can proceed as we have
eliminated the draft.
That's fine.
All right, that's the way it'll be handled.
I might mention, too, as most of you are aware, that as we have circulated the tentative drafts, we have included introductory material in connection with the draft, pointing out that none of these drafts contain any penalty sections, and that each of these drafts will be reviewed further as part of a comprehensive grading scheme and appropriate designations of particular class of crime will be made for each of the drafts of articles that have already been approved. So there is a caveat on that as it's being circulated each time, so that they will know that the commission is aware that the penalties have not yet been designated.
By the way, we have several guests here. Some of us have met them, some of us have not. Would you mind starting over here, standing and introducing yourself so we'll know how much we can say?
I'm Doc Glenn, my district attorney of Yamhill County.
Lou Williams, district attorney of Columbia.
Jack Collier.
Thank you, gentlemen. You're certainly welcome.
I have a question in general. I take it that it's implicit in this draft is the notion that robbery in the third degree is in effect a lesser included crime. Similarly, robbery in the second degree is a lesser included crime, and so on. In other words, your typical situation, if there's a gun involved, the state may not be able to prove that the gun was actually loaded, and that leads you into your inference of a loaded gun, or if the gun isn't loaded, then presumably it would be second degree and so on. But I take it that that everybody understands that in this particular instance, at least, these are lesser included crimes.
I think commentary covers that. Defendant who is tried under subsection 1 or 2 of section 3 could be found guilty of the lesser included crimes of second or third degree robbery, depending upon the nature of the evidence regarding the weapon to be used thereof by the defendant.
Page 2.
And we really, I was showing in the minutes that that's what there, I think we discussed this here in the last page too, is that going into section 3 here where it says deadly weapon and uses or attempts to use a dangerous weapon, that we intend to define some weapons as being deadly and they are deadly, and that others are dangerous or can be dangerous no matter what they use.
Right.
They're not deadly per se.
Yeah, there's a paragraph in the commentary on that on page 2.
Well, that'll be in the general definition section.
Right.
I wonder, that poses a question in my mind I'd like to raise. There is a definition of deadly weapon in the Model Penal Code under the section on homicide, 210.1, I think it is. And that definition, with respect to deadly weapon and homicide, is going to be in conflict. If we use that, it's going to be in conflict with the deadly dangerous categories of of the robbery section, clearly. The deadly weapon definition under homicide includes both deadly and dangerous, the way I read it, although there's no comment to help us on that, by the way, in any of the draft.
What's the number of that, John?
I think it's 210, John. 210-1.
That's set out in page 3 of your commentary, that modified code definition.
Yeah, see, it's Don has it in his comment. It cuts across, and the point I'm raising is that if in fact the desirable to put the definitions of deadly and dangerous weapons in the general definition section, then of course that must apply wherever the word deadly weapon is used elsewhere.
Well, you will recall that, Mr. Chairman, if I may interject, at our last full commission meeting, we considered the section on burglary, and we employed the same terms, deadly and dangerous weapons, in the burglary statute as we are in robbery. And we did have some discussion of this at that time, and it was the intent of the subcommittee, and I thought the intent of the full commission, that these would be defined in the general definition section. And the same would hold true, I would assume.
Well, I'm staying on notice then.
Yes,
this will be general and would probably necessitate using both deadly and dangerous within the homicide section if you lack that
sufficient. And make a departure in that respect from the Model Penal Code.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman? Are you satisfied, Senator Burns, with Section 3, Subsection 4, is aided by another person actually present?
We had some lengthy discussion concerning that, and I would assume probably that we'll renew some of that discussion today. I thought maybe, Dale, of course it's up to how any commission wants to go, but I thought maybe if we handled these section by section for purposes of tentative approval by the commission, it might expedite it. And I will have something to say about that. I'm sure Don Coletta will too. I think there's some justification for having it. But could I defer answering the question until we act on one, or it's up to the chairman.
I think probably it would be best if we would approve or disapprove of each one section at a time, starting with section 130.
Does it bother anybody that we start out by having third degree in section 1?
It does me.
And first degree in section 3, or is there a reason for that?
Yeah, we've purposely set out to do it that way with ascending degrees. In other words, starting with the basic definition of the crime, where in most cases in these drafts, the higher degrees of the crime is going to be the basic crime with some aggravating factor. And that it seemed to be more logical to start, if it's going to be your basic definition, and that's going to be the lowest degree, to put that first, rather than starting off with the highest and working your way down to the lowest. And this way, as a drafting technique, we can relate back to a previous section and say this is the same crime as in section 1, except that there's some aggravating factor now.
Well, you add rather than subtract, say that first degree robbery is that described in third degree, but in addition, he has one of these other things rather than saying, describing what first degree robbery is, and then subtracting in second degree that it's the same as first degree except that he only threatens or, accept things. I think it's easier to add than it is to subtract.
It's also a defense technique. If in the event that the defense counsel wants to differ with the DA, he doesn't have to read the whole statute. A lesser degree tops.
I'll move
the adoption of section 1. I guess we're taking it by section
You mean to say you're in favor of the third degree?
Right.
Well, I forget how we did it the last time, Mr. Chairman. Did
somebody move on?
Yeah, you took...
Is there any further discussion on Section 1? All those in favor of approving Section 1, preliminary draft number 3 under robbery, will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
All right. Now, Mr. Chairman, robbery in the second degree is the significant change that we have made in preliminary draft 3. And if you will look to the minutes of August 9th, the subcommittee, the discussion there was to the effect that the addition of this section would subject a robber who used, for example, a toy gun to a more severe penalty than a robber who used no weapon. This goes back to the basic policy consideration underlying this departure that we've made from the present law, in that we are trying to get at the fear in the mind of the offended. Is this not right, Don?
Well,
explain that.
Well, actually, we're primarily concerned, I think, with the possibility of threat to the bodily security of the victim, and that's reflected, I think, to say that that's the most serious degree of robbery. But at the same time, we are recognizing that the use of a toy weapon or the threatened use of a weapon, even by a robber who has no weapon, for example, the finger in the pocket or just the note saying, I've got a gun and hand me your money, that this does increase the terror to the victim ordinarily and does facilitate the commission of the crime. And for that reason, it's looked upon in this draft as more serious. But at the same time, I think the primary rationale of robbery is the danger to the victim, the actual danger. And as I noted in the commentary on Section 2, states that it should be noted that under the provisions of Section 2, the state would not be required to prove that the defendant was actually armed or that he used or attempted to use a weapon. But since there's no more danger, actual danger, to the victim, then there would have been an actual unarmed robbery, which would have been robbery in the third degree. The mere threat to use a gun by itself should not raise the crime to the highest degree of robbery in the first degree.
Under our former draft, it would.
Yes.
Right. It was a distinction, wasn't it, between which was more important. One, the fear under which the victim, the fear that the victim has, rather than the actual danger to which he's really exposed. And this distinguishes.
And I think the general tone of the discussion at the last commission meeting was the question of, well, what about the unarmed robber who says he has a gun and this type of thing? And under the first draft that we considered in the commission, that would have been treated as unarmed robbery. It would have been treated as unarmed robbery and not armed robbery. But, and so what we attempted to do here was to satisfy the criticism that was directed at that previous draft, and that it really didn't meet the situation where there's a threatened use of a gun. And trying to clarify that this is going to be looked upon as more serious, but at the same time, recognizing that it really is, in effect, more danger, more actual danger.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering about a robbery or an attempt where the threat is by an act rather than a verbal or a written or other representation. Do you feel, John, that or other representation takes in an act?
Well, I felt yes. That's why we use that broad language, trying to cover just any sort of a gesture, say, or, for example, blow a hand in the pocket, or it may not say anything, but it conveys the impression
that he has done. Would it be better to say act or representation? Either act or
would it do any harm to insert by any act or any verbal, written, or other representation? Well, besides, I will move to insert after the word by and before the word any act or.
Mr. Chairman, the thing that I'm not sure about is, among many things I'm not sure about, what is the difference between threatens the immediate use in section 2 and attempts to use in section 3 sub 2?
May I respond, Mr.
Chairman? Yes.
I believe, I'm sorry, I thought you were referring to the old draft, but you're obviously not.
Well, I think there's a great deal of difference between this section 2, the second you wrote, we would have the finger in the coat or pocket, a toy gun, something like this, whereas section 2 is where he's got a club, a knife, or something like this, but he's actually got a dangerous type of weapon that he has there using, threatening with it, out in the open rather than.
However, if you depending upon what kind of a definition we arrive at on dangerous weapon, this unloaded gun situation is one which occurs day after day. One essential part of every armed robbery case. Because normally the state isn't able to prove whether or not the gun was actually loaded. And I don't know how a court is going to construe the words threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon. Particularly if we add by any act, as well as by verbal representation, and attempts to use a dangerous weapon, particularly if, as has been pointed out in the earlier minutes, there is an inference that it's a bootstrap inference, but there's an inference that the use of a weapon, use of a pistol or a gun in a robbery permits the jury to infer that it was loaded. And then you instruct them that if it's loaded, it's a dangerous weapon as a matter of law, and you bootstrap the whole thing. Now, maybe we can clear this up in our definition. I don't know. particularly where you don't have, at least I'm not aware, case construction of the terms threatens the immediate use, and then compare that with attempts to use. How do you attempt to use, for example, a dangerous weapon?
Well, I think the example of a club.
Well, take your pistol example. Suppose it's a poison fact. We know later, for some reason, that it was in fact a toy pistol. Normally, you're not going to find the gun on the defendant, and he might say, well, it was a toy pistol, but nobody's going to believe him anyway. So you've still got the situation of it's a pistol. And you don't know whether it's loaded or not.
Well, isn't that a matter of proof? Under Section 2, the only difference is that under Section 3, he would have to have a dangerous weapon.
Well, but you get back to, now again, if we clear this up with our definition, that's fine, but if you use a gun in a robbery, the jury is entitled to infer that it was loaded.
Right.
It, by the way, it's not presumption, it's an inference, because they used the term presumption in an earlier case and they cleaned it up later.
Right.
In other words, let us say it's kind of looks like a little toy pistol, but in any event, he gets $75 from the Plaid Pantry, and later they find him, identify him, but the gun isn't on him. Is that going to be second degree or first degree robbery?
Well, Don, let me ask you this. In the definitions, will there be anything to enlighten us as to whether or not an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon or not, as related to this section?
Well, statute? I think certainly that's an issue that has to be met, and I think that our definitions are going to have to distinguish between the two, or at least say that we don't consider there's any difference between an unloaded and a loaded gun for the purposes of classifying that as a deadly weapon. However, if you'll notice, for example, the New York definitions, they define deadly weapon means any loaded weapon. But even a definition of weapon that classifies a deadly weapon as a loaded one does not get to your question of proof and what the jury is entitled to infer. And if we adopted verbatim these definitions that New York has, you would still have the question of proof and whether or not this was in fact a loaded weapon. But
you still have the problem of what does it mean to attempt to use a dangerous weapon as opposed to threaten the immediate use of a dangerous weapon? What activity?
Well, you could threaten to use a dangerous weapon and not have one at all. Whereas if you're going to attempt to use a dangerous weapon,
sure, I appreciate that. That's the finger in the pocket or the note saying I've got 45 under my belt and I'm going to use it, and so on. But where the quote weapon, close quote, is actually displayed. This is your toy pistol situation. And it's one that's very frequently occurs. Then, does that amount to second degree or first degree robbery?
I'd say second degree, very clearly. Well,
why?
Because it is not a dangerous weapon. Here it's displayed, it's a toy pistol.
Mr. Chairman.
Gordon?
The question occurs to me in response to Jim's concern here is if you would strike out the words in sub 2 of section 3, the words for attempts to use. I'm wondering if there is any difference between using and attempting to use. If a man has a club, attempting to use is swinging it. He may not hit the man, but what's the difference between that and using it? Using it, I assume, is swinging the club or holding it up with a threatening gesture, and attempting to use would be exactly the same thing. And why wouldn't it, if you just put use, wouldn't that
instead of the club, what if it were a gun?
Beg pardon?
Instead of the club, what if it were a gun? There's a difference between uses and attempts to use there.
Well, he uses a gun by pointing it, or he threatens to hit him, or it seems to me like
I don't know. Just pointing it.
But how do you distinguish attempting to use
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
That subsection 2 formerly was uses or threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon. We took the threatening out of that and put it in subsection 2. I think there is a distinction, Justice Sloan. But let me try to respond first to Judge Burns' comment and give you some for instances which underlie the committee's discussions. We thought that second degree would cover the situation where the person would go into a store, the other person would give the clerk a note and say, I have a gun in my pocket, unless you give me the money, I'm going to pull it out and shoot you. Now, assuming that person didn't have a gun in his pocket, he threatened the immediate use of a dangerous weapon, and he'd be guilty of second degree robbery. If he did in fact have a gun in his pocket, and he was apprehended with it on him, and it was loaded, it would rise to the dignity of being armed with a dangerous weapon, and he'd be subject to first degree. But assuming that all, that the proof simply rose to the dignity of recitation that he gave his note, then it would be second degree. The same if he came in and he says, I have some dynamite in this little bag, and if you don't hand over the money, I'm going to blow this up. Or if he put a finger in his pocket, the gesture. Now, getting more directly to your, so we thought that this should be covered under a lesser degree of robbery than under first degree, as in the former draft, where uses or threatens the immediate use would make this first degree robbery, even if he didn't in fact have a gun. Now, getting to your questions, we thought that uses contemplated more of a completed act. We would say, for example, and recommend the committee defining these terms, that a weapon which was loaded would rise to the dignity of a deadly weapon, but a gun, for example, that was unloaded would be a dangerous weapon. Now, if I went into your store with an unloaded gun and pulled it out and pointed it at you to give me your money, and it was shown at the trial that that was an unloaded gun, I'd still be subject to first degree because I used an unloaded gun. But if I went into your store and said, I'm going to rob you, and started to pull the gun out of my pocket, and some store detective grabbed me from behind, it could very well be argued that I hadn't in fact used that gun. So unless we had the attempts to use provision in there, this could be reduced to second degree. So I kind of think, and the subcommittee felt, that this attempts to use does play a role. There are already cases where a beer bottle, you know, a broken beer bottle is a dangerous weapon. There's a couple of Klamath County Indian assault cases that are on this. But what if I go into the local pub and take a beer bottle and break it and say, any so-and-so that interferes with me, I'm going to let it happen. I haven't, in effect, used that yet, have I? But it could be argued that I maybe have attempted to use it. Maybe I'm more properly threatening it. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like Jack Collier here, one of the most skillful and resourceful defense lawyers in Multnomah County area, and I'd like to ask him to get his view on this. If he's defending a fellow and he sees these two sections here, what would he do to cut it down? So that, in other words, his aim would be, he'd be right in there at the close of the state's case or at the close of all the evidence saying, move for a directed verdict on first degree. And therefore, the only thing you can submit to the jury is second degree. Isn't that what you've been doing? And I think someone like Jack, who's in this business every day.
Jack, before you go into that, for those of you who don't know him, this is Senator Tom Mahoney. Glad to see you here, Tom. Just came in. How are you?
I'm Tumman. I must apologize. I said I didn't be here at 11. I was 2 minutes late.
Put that down.
First time in my career I've been late meeting this full commission.
Jack?
It's the first commission. I'd be inclined to think that, Jack, you might use that these two sections to hang a jury in.
Tell us how.
I would submit that the state would be arguing that there was a use and an attempt to use making this a first degree. Well, I'm thinking now specifically about Johnny Burns' beer bottle situation.
I withdraw my comment about that. I think Frank Knight's right. I think it would be threatening. But I don't withdraw the comment about attempting to use the gun, because I think it's applicable there.
What if he reaches for his gun in his belt and the security officer, he's reaching for his gun and he seizes him? He doesn't get to use it. What other than an attempt to use would cover that situation?
I would think that would be an attempt to use.
Well, to me, that answers
the situation where you're walking in, where the fellow walks in, he hasn't moved at all. He first threatens, maybe with a note, maybe orally, or maybe just, you know, give me your money. Then the fellow behind the counter walks and starts to reach. That would be an attempt, wouldn't it?
If he actually had the dangerous weapon. So that's why that's a distinction I see.
I take it that implicit in your comment here is that there is evidence at the trial that the gun was loaded.
Then you get into the deadly weapon situation.
then presumably the case is going to be one in which there isn't any evidence. This is the normal situation. True, when the security guard grabs him, then you can prove it. But in the average situation, he's not apprehended that quickly. He's outside the store, several blocks away, he's got rid of the gun, or he's picked up later in the lineup or something of that sort. And you don't know. He's going to say, of course, that if he has to take the stand, he's going to say, well, the gun wasn't loaded, but you really don't know, and the jury doesn't have to believe it.
Well, the jury's going to make that determination in any event.
Right, but if there's no proof either that the gun was or wasn't loaded, now, is that going to be a Section 2, a second-degree violation or a first-degree violation?
The court would... if they couldn't prove anything, proof either way?
Yeah, it seems to me that the attempt to use provision is necessary.
As being a gun.
You're missing something, I think, Jim. The attempt to use provision is necessary in the case where there is evidence that the gun was unloaded. Because assuming that the unloaded gun is classed as a dangerous weapon, and he attempts to use it, and is apprehended in the act of it, and then is able to prove at the trial that the gun was unloaded, it's the fact that he attempted to use the dangerous weapon in the name of the state to show that this is first degree.
What if the definition of dangerous weapon says that the unloaded gun is not?
Pardon me.
Well, then it goes
further back. What was your comment on that?
I was saying, what if the under the definition section, it provides that an unloaded gun is not a dangerous weapon?
That's the term.
Yeah.
In other words,
a deadly weapon. I mean a deadly weapon.
If the defendant or the accused had a pistol, it isn't loaded. It's not a dangerous weapon.
No, it would be a deadly weapon, but not. It would be a dangerous weapon, but not a deadly weapon.
So then, let's say the weapon is not loaded. Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous weapon.
But not a deadly one.
Oh, is there then provided any distinction in the gravamen of the offense if it is or is not loaded?
That's just what we're discussing now, in a sense, under first degree. John Burns maintains that if the definitions provide that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon, but not a deadly one, then someone who uses or attempts to use that unloaded gun, everything else being present, would be guilty of robbery in the first degree. Isn't that your position, John?
That's the recommendation.
Well, shouldn't there be a distinction between a weapon which is loaded and not loaded, as far as the penalty is concerned?
Well, there is in the present law, the subcommittee has made a departure from that by providing that if you attempt to use the dangerous weapon, the unloaded gun, that then you're guilty of first degree. Now, there's several different ways that you can use a dangerous weapon. I can go in and rob your store and hit you over the head with a beer bottle or a club or pistol whip you with a gun. Or conceivably, I could just point the gun at you or threaten you with the beer bottle.
Well, I take it that implicit in this discussion is that if I walk in with a .22 caliber pistol, and in fact the proof later shows it was unloaded, and I walk in and I point at the storekeeper and say, hand over $75, that is first degree robbery.
If we adopt this, that's correct.
According to Senator Byrne. Now, but implicit also in what Don says and what the commentary says, if it is a toy pistol, and I walk in and point it and say, hand over the $75, then it's robbery in the second degree. Now,
here's a problem for you. Suppose we have a weapon that was deadly 70 years ago. Let's say a cap and ball pistol. Or let's assume it's a relatively new pistol. It's not functional. It may well be loaded. In the case of a cap, how would you classify a cap and ball pistol? Where possibly you can't get caps or powder or balls to fire you. Now the man walks in, I'm thinking of an instance where a man walks in with this weapon. It's a real weapon, but it's not functional. It may well be loaded, and he points it. Is he attempting to use it, or is he just threatening the use of a dangerous weapon?
Well, I don't think it's going to make any difference, Jack, because in either event, you could convict him of first-degree robbery. Because if it's a deadly weapon, because it's a loaded revolver or pistol, then he's armed with it, regardless of what he's done with it. He's armed with it.
Function.
So then it's a dangerous instrument, or a dangerous weapon because of the nature of the use he's put it to, and you're not going to have to prove that it was loaded. Because he's pointed it at the victim. That's
well, am I threatening or attempting?
Of course. Mr. Chairman, the effect on the victim is the same as the weapon is. It's only used to put in fear. I speak from personal circumstance, but it was set up. And having read it while I had an atomic cannon there, but it seems to me there should be some distinction in the ultimate danger, of some trigger-happy person coming in with a weapon which is loaded, because the potential there is enormously dangerous. That's what I'm trying to think.
Well, we went into that whole discussion as to which should be the most important thing. The actual danger in which the victim finds himself, or the fear to which he is put during the course of this thing. And initially, if I remember correctly, the minutes will show it, but when Don was discussing this matter, I thought that he said that we were departing somewhat from present law, and emphasis was being placed upon precisely what you say, namely, the actual danger to which the victim is put, rather than to the fear that he's put under. Now, in this situation here, where a person comes in and actually uses or attempts to use this unloaded gun, then the actual danger to which that man is exposed is not great. But the fear to which he's placed is exactly the same as though it were a deadly weapon.
Now, Mr. Chairman, we were charged by commission to make this distinction.
Yes, that's true.
Senator Mahoney has raised. I'm not satisfied completely with it, and this has been a profitable discussion. But we thought was that the actual danger to the victim would be less under a circumstance as drawn in second degree robbery here, yeah, where a person threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon, either by a note or a finger in the pocket or whatever. It would be less, the actual danger would be less in that instance than in the instance where the robber attempted to use or did in fact use a dangerous weapon. Now, I think we get hung up on the word use, maybe. Because when we talk about the gun, certainly if it's an unloaded gun that I use by pointing at you, the actual danger to you isn't any greater than if I had my finger in the pocket. But if I had that unloaded gun that I used by cracking you across your head, danger to you, the actual danger to you would be considerably more.
How do you find use?
How do you use a gun? Do you use it only by firing it or by pointing it?
For striking with
it. Yeah.
Do you distinguish between uses and carries?
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that they're asking what they're talking about danger to the victim, and the fear of the victim as far as distinguishing things here. That, okay, a deadly weapon, which is a loaded pistol, that clearly the danger is there as well as the fear. A toy pistol or a finger in the pocket, some fear will be there, yes, but the danger isn't there at all, because then we put that back in second degree. But that even though it is an unloaded pistol, it's capable of being loaded and becoming a deadly weapon, where there is some, there's a greater danger to a victim from an unloaded gun than there is from a toy gun, as far as what can develop in the course of the robbery.
Why would that be? The only difference I can see is he's more apt to have a heart attack, because if that gun is unloaded, we're talking only about the moment when this occurs. It can be loaded, of course. What if he doesn't have any shells with him? It couldn't even be loaded then.
Yeah.
I see no distinction between a toy and under the first section or section two either.
Here's when you talk about, we have a problem down there. What is it? A loaded gun, even, because the old case is the cap and ball case, where if you don't have the powder in it, it's not loaded, even though the ball is in there. So you get a revolver or
the firing pin removed.
You get one where the shells are in the
magazine,
but not up in the chamber. Now, we've had a ruling that down in the magazine, all you need to do is make a whip of the lever, that it's not loaded. Which, because of the old cap and ball case, you see.
And Jake?
Well, I hope I'm not rehashing anything, because it's been late on that phone. Aren't we talking really about the general level of danger? I think that there are. Danger is also increased by the use of an unloaded weapon, probably because of the response that comes. If we have cases of grocers shooting back, and that kind of thing. I think there was one grocer in Portland who shot a second robber a couple months ago. Maybe society wouldn't shed too many tears for the robbers. Gunplay itself is dangerous, and passersby can be hurt, and all that. The reaction of people to a man with a gun does not depend upon whether the gun is loaded or not. And the general danger level increases. The other thing which has been mentioned is the question of proof. I don't know how you can really rebut the testimony of a person, let's say with an automatic, as opposed to a revolver, who says, well, I didn't have a clip in the gun, or something of that nature, or firing pin wasn't in. He comes in, there's no way to rebut it, and it seems to automatically reduce it.
That discussion came up before, and that's one of the reasons that this was put in.
Mr. Chairman, looking at this now in a practical way, I can see where the prosecution, if there were, is distinction between loaded and unloaded, but have a very onerous obligation or duty to prove after the defendant is apprehended that at the time the pistol was loaded. They have no way of knowing, Mr. Shackle.
That's a very
I can see a practical difficulty there, that there would be somewhat honest.
That's the reason for the inference.
Because the only one who actually would know subsequently whether the weapon was loaded is the defendant.
And that's the reason why the court's created the
inference. I'm new at this, you know, I'm just trying to learn.
Well, this would have disturbed the inference, the language we have in this draft. At least I don't think it would.
Well, I didn't think it would either, and it seems to me that in your fake gun situation is where you're going to have a lot of trouble because, well, let's say it later turns out, either by way of recovery of the weapon or by way of possibly someone else seeing the weapon who can describe it, and so the proof comes in that it's a toy gun or a fake weapon and so on. But the fact of it is, the victim who's immediately confronted with it, he doesn't know it's a toy weapon. And he's scared to death and he hands over the $75.
Right.
Now, then, as I understand it, assuming that the proof shows specifically that it's a toy gun, then it would become robbery in the second degree.
Yes.
Because the inference wouldn't apply and so on. Now, I'm not at all sure that that's the kind of a result we want to achieve. Maybe it is.
Well, in which direction do you think it's wrong? Do you think it should be a lesser crime than second degree or a higher one?
Well, the fact that the gun later turns out to be a toy or a fake, as opposed to later turning out to be simply a 22 that has no shells in it, seems to me to be a pretty flimsy distinction in terms of the fear created in the mind of the victim and the danger to everybody around if the victim reacts as the way someone would, like the chap at the Texaco service station over on Broadway recently that shot the robber dead, just like that.
Well.
I certainly agree that the pointing the finger or handing a note is a logical way to distinguish and to reduce it to a lesser degree. But the toy pistol distinction, I'm not so sure that I would agree that that's a sound distinction to draw.
Well, I think we agree on this. I think it's just a question to what degree we agree, and that is because under existing law, your toy gun situation, you're not going to get a conviction for armed robbery. It would end up as unarmed robbery, which would have been the effect in our earlier draft of this. It would continue the present state of the Oregon law. This goes the happy medium route and says that even though it's a toy gun, the law is going to look upon this as more serious, and it's going to be second degree rather than plain old third degree or unarmed robbery. But it's not going to be as serious as an actual deadly weapon or dangerous weapon situation.
I take it also, however, that in your situation of an unloaded 22, or at least let us say a 22 that at trial there is some testimony that it was unloaded, presumably from the defendant, that could still be capable of being first degree robbery.
Sure. Yeah, I think that could be first degree robbery, either under sub 1 or sub 2 of section 3.
Now,
Dale?
Mr. Chairman, I think this has been extremely enlightening discussion for me anyway. And many of the comments have been made, I agree with it, but I think I see what the draftsman has been doing. And I see the point that Judge Burns is raising here. I think it's a good one. I wonder in section 2 if we added. Mr. Norton proposed an amendment. I think Judge Byrd makes a real good point about this toy weapon. Why not some words after of a dangerous weapon or a weapon of reasonably appears danger, something to that effect? I think if you take care of the situation, you eliminate the objections that we're getting to Section 3. I at first thought you should not discriminate between a loaded and an unloaded gun. But I think Mr. Follett's comments about uses or attempts clarifies that for me. I like it the way it is, except I think the toy gun should be covered, and I think the reasonable apprehension in the mind of the victim is important in the result produced.
Well, Dale, you already have that, though, reasonably appears to be, because in Section 2, it's unimportant whether he actually has that, whether it's a toy gun or not. If he threatens the use of a dangerous weapon.
But a toy gun wouldn't be a dangerous weapon, would it?
Yeah, this is a
no, but he threatens the use of it, whether he has it, even if he doesn't have one.
Well, I interpret that.
Yeah, I think we should make clear there's going to be a legislative intent that by threatening the immediate use of a dangerous weapon, we mean the a pretended dangerous weapon,
yeah,
as well as a real dangerous weapon, because I mean, the way they would defend against the toy pistol in arguing to the judge for their judgment of acquittal, or to reduce clear down to the third degree, is that he was threatening the use of there was a toy pistol, which isn't even a dangerous weapon.
Supposing that he doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
He has a finger in his pocket.
Yeah.
It's less dangerous than the toy pistol, and he says, now I'm going to use a gun. That's what he threatens, and he doesn't even have one.
He's threatening to use a dangerous weapon.
But the important word here is threatens the immediate use, not dangerous weapon. No, he doesn't have to have a dangerous weapon at all. Jack,
I
didn't clarify the more point.
Possibly there's a situation where a toy pistol is a dangerous weapon. Let's assume
it's
one of these cast replicas.
It could be. Yeah.
Cloud falling again.
Then it would be first degree by causes
coming back to Judge Burns. If you were going to amend this thing, am I correct in this, that you would want to place the toy pistol situation in the same category in Section 3, first degree?
No. I think the reason I'm confused is everybody so far has said this is a very helpful discussion, and I think I've tried, except all that happened to me is I got more confused. Basically, I don't really care about throwing the toy pistol situation into Section 2 as second degree robbery. The danger I foresee is the only evidence that comes on is a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no affirmative evidence that it was loaded. And even perhaps some evidence that, let's say, that wouldn't fire anyway, or was just a toy or something like that, allowing that to slide from first degree down to second degree. And it seems to me that, depending upon the definitions you adopt, that a defense lawyer would certainly argue that where there is nothing more there, let's say the evidence of defendant or someone else says, well, it was a toy or it was a fake pistol or something like that, he's going to be arguing, judge, the most you can submit to the jury is second degree robbery. And
isn't that the situation now where they're arguing to reduce it from armed to unarmed?
District attorney, on the other hand, is going to be arguing, no, judge, this is an attempt to use a dangerous weapon. And it's dangerous, or at least it can be dangerous, because the jury can draw the inference, and therefore it is an attempt to use, and therefore you should submit both first and second degree.
In the toy pistol case?
I'm talking about the one in which it is, in which there's evidence from which a fact finder could find it's a real gun, or that it's a real gun unloaded, or that it's a fake gun.
Well, the court would instruct that jury if this were a real gun, whether it was loaded or not, and if he used it or attempted to use it, that they could find him guilty of robbery in the first degree. If, on the other hand, they found that it was not a real gun,
but rather a toy pistol, that they could not find him, whether he used or attempted to use it, unless it, by its very nature, that toy pistol came into the category of a dangerous weapon by reason of the manner in which it could be used, then that they could only find him guilty of robbery in the second degree. Is that, yes, or third?
Yeah, or third.
It would be the same situation that you have now where they're trying to get you to submit the lesser included, but the criterion here that would be persuasive if they found that it was a loaded gun would be whether there was any evidence of overtness with respect to its use or attempted use. I mean, this is a new element that is injected into it.
Well, it would seem to me that if you had a robber who comes in, and say he has what appears to be a revolver in his belt, and he opens his coat and displays that to the victim says this man had a deadly weapon on him, or he describes this to him, that would, the testimony of the victim would be evidence tending to show that he was armed with a deadly weapon, I would think. Just that testimony. And then if the defense brings in evidence to show that what he had in his belt was a wooden gun, you're not then thrown into the situation where it's not armed robbery, it's unarmed robbery. You go back into this section two, which the displaying of this purported weapon would be threatening the use of it.
And would be an included offense under the Impact Act.
Yes. And the intent here, not the intent of this draft was to strengthen the existing law and to put another degree in here to reach this situation. And maybe we're just confusing the whole area rather than clearing it up. But the intent certainly was to look upon this as more serious for the simple reason that it does facilitate, in most instances, the commission of the crime and does terrorize the victim. And it should have some prophylactic effect because of that. It is going to be treated as a more serious crime than unarmed robbery, whereas under the existing law, you're going to have to prove that he was armed with a dangerous weapon. And that toy gun is unlikely, you're going to be able to show that was a dangerous weapon under your existing definitions of dangerous weapon in the cases, the way I read it. Would you agree with that, Nick?
My thought's great. I was thinking of something else. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman,
when I started straying, though, up to that point, I agree.
Well, I should have quit at that point.
Could you tell us where that point was? Dale?
I'm about ready to move to the adoption of section 2 as written, but it's kind of
well,
my
I
mind.
Think you got a motion, don't
we?
We
have
a
yes,
amen.
George?
John, was there any particular reason why you chose attempt rather than threatening?
Well, George, we took threatening and moved it up to section 2 because, as you'll note, our previous draft, where what you sent back to us had said subsection 2 of robbery in the first degree was uses or threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon, and the commission felt that this didn't provide, well, we're getting back to what we're talking about, actual danger.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd put threaten up in the lesser degree where there really wasn't as much actual danger, and you put attempts to use down in first degree where the actual danger is enhanced.
Did you make that choice consciously, keeping in mind the fact that attempt is a word of art that's going to be dealt with in the court crime section, and I think injects an element here that, well, this element. When one attempts to commit a crime, when we look at it in the context of the Inchoate Crimes article, roughly the definition would be conduct shall not be held to constitute a substantial step under this subsection, unless it is strongly corroborative of the actor's criminal purpose. All right, now the emphasis in attempt, although the language may be different in the actual section the commission adopts, but the emphasis now in most modern codes is on the substantial step doctrine, which means, I think, in the situation where we have the actor coming into the tavern, the very fact that he has a gun on his person when he's sitting in the car outside is an attempt to use a gun. Because the attempt section focuses on the dangerousness of the actor and his dangerous characteristics, not on the, as we've been talking about, the fear of the victim. So that actually, I don't think you've intended this, but I think it's implicit in the use of the word intent that you're moving much farther away from the actual or so-called last proximate act with respect to the use or threat of the weapon.
Do I understand you to say that under the substantial step doctrine, the fact that he has the gun in the car and puts it in his pocket and walks into the tavern with it, intending to use it in robbery, constitutes an attempt to use it?
Yes, generally speaking, I think that would be so. Now, there's a line between preparation and intent. This is the big problem in the law of intent.
Well, I don't think, I'm not sure that...
All I'm suggesting, perhaps, is that I think if we're going to use a word of art, I would feel more comfortable if the word threatens were used also in section 3. Uses or threatens a dangerous weapon, rather than uses or attempts to use it. Attempt moves, I think, the concept of attempt as it will be developed in the Code Crime section, moves the line much farther away from what we're really dealing with here. In other words, moves the line back to allow the law enforcement to intervene earlier than you really intend with respect to the particular problem that's facing you.
We were not unmindful of the fact that attempt would be covered in the Code Crime section because there is, in fact, some discussion in the minutes about this very thing. We were not mindful of this substantial step doctrine. I am not sure that it would be consistent with present Oregon cases on this, I don't think, but you raise an interesting point. I personally would think that any trial judge, if the DA requested an instruction on a Kemp and there wasn't any evidence that there was an overt act of some type, that no judge would give such an instruction.
Well,
I wonder
we're actually getting ahead of ourselves in discussing policy issues of attempt. But I would only say now that the drafting that I've done so far on this will have the effect of changing, apparently, the law in Oregon and moving the criminal, the line at which the law enforcement officer may intervene much farther back than the old so-called last proximate act, and I'm not sure that's even an effective word. But anyway, it focuses on the dangerous characteristic of the actor, not on what actually may happen. You never may get in the presence of his intended victim with respect to the concept of attempt, and yet a crime has been committed. Here, we're always in the presence of the victim. We're talking about the robbery.
You may be threatened.
But we're really talking about terrorism rather than the dangerous characteristic, the thrust of the substantial step doctrine of attempt, which focuses on the actor himself, not what may actually happen to other people or victims.
George, I have two questions. One, if you did change that to threaten, you'd have the identical offense that appears in second degree. I think that you would. Now, secondly, could we use some sort of a word or terminology here that would make it clear that what we're talking about when we say attempts to use the dangerous weapon, that isn't in the preparation stage, but immediately at the time of the commission of that, well, it started earlier, but the immediate use of it at the time in the presence of the victim. Is there immediate or some word or terminology that we could use with attempt?
Well, I suppose there must be, and the only point I'm making is that we ought to be awfully careful if we're going to use a word of art that's being used somewhere else in the code.
Can you think of a terminology that would make it clear that we're using attempt in the presence of that victim?
When you start talking about attempt being thrown clear back and changing the definition of attempt. We've got it right up here in third degree robbery in the course of committing or attempting to commit theft.
Yes, but that is in the pure sense of the concept of the inchoate crime.
Well, isn't that the distinction, though, George? Isn't there a distinction between an attempted crime?
Yes.
So,
as
you distinguish an attempt from preparation and an attempt to use a weapon.
And may I interrupt the show? The dining room downstairs is closed. Shall we have Miller to call the hotel and see if we can't get room there for lunch? Any objections?
We have room reserved for tomorrow. I did not reserve one for today.
Will everyone that's here, will they be able to attend?
No, I have to go back to my office tomorrow, so I'll miss.
All right. One, two, you can go down. You can. How many, everybody raise their hands that can go down to the hotel for lunch. One, two, three, four, five, six, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12. Pardon me, Pedro.
Is this on the chairman?
No, this is a Dutch deal. You've got the tightest chairman in town. It's going to be a fast I should have brought the garbanzos. Now,
we'll see. Where were we?
I don't think I want to force you into an argument that perhaps is not appropriate. Don makes a good point. The way you use attempt here, I don't think is in the same sense at all of the inchoate crime of attempt. And yet it's the same word. That's what bothers me. And if we use the same word in various places in the code, sometimes it's difficult when the code is silent for a court or someone later having to construe that word of art. What does it mean? Well, it must mean what's been said to mean under the inchoate crime section. It must have that thrust of meaning.
Actually, the meaning is uses or starts to use.
Commences or tries to use.
Right. But this is a problem. Those words aren't words that you use in models.
George, may I ask a question on that? Just a period of news days. In a thing like this, to what extent will, like commentary, be governing on this? It would be included, I assume, in the eventual report, in which the commentary would explain the kind of conduct that is prohibited by Section 2 as being that where the person comes in and does not actually exhibit to his victim a weapon, but says, I have one available and can use it if you don't do as I say. Now, as I understand the comment here, everybody agrees this is what they're talking about.
Plus the toy pistol.
Plus. Well, at least to me, I don't see how you can bring a toy pistol into subsection or into Section 2. Any time you actually exhibit a thing, then it's either number 3 or number 1.
Well, I disagree.
And I certainly disagree under existing law, Judge. A toy weapon under existing law, you're going to have unarmed robbery.
Well,
that's
not going to amount to
a
dangerous weapon.
Well, that's why I say a toy gun is not a dangerous weapon. I assume under the definitions you will develop.
Right.
Or under present definitions.
Right.
So that if he exhibits a toy pistol, he is not attempting to the use of a dangerous weapon.
Would this be rendered more precise, Don, if we said in sub 2 of section 3, uses or attempts to use an actual dangerous weapon? I mean, because I disagree with Justice Sloan's interpretation of 2.
But
what we're talking about is in 3 is an actual dangerous weapon.
Well, I think that's clear enough. When we say attempt to use a dangerous weapon, that's what we're talking about. The definition is
yeah. But yet, it's the same thing that Dale mentioned before. Either threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon or a pretended dangerous weapon or something. That when you're when you're using a toy pistol, that's, I mean, at least this is what the defense is going to argue to the court, that they're not threatening the use of a dangerous weapon because they're only threatening the use of a toy pistol. So it has to go clear back to third degree rather than back to second degree, because how can you threaten the use of immediate use of a dangerous weapon when it's clear all you got there is a toy?
Are you talking about second degree now?
Yeah.
Well, here's why I think that isn't consistent, because under second degree, you wouldn't even have to expose or show any type of a weapon so long as you threaten to use a dangerous weapon, whether you had it or not.
So that I agree that with the finger in your coat, you're threatening by an act or appearance, you're appearing that you've got a dangerous weapon there, take care of it, or just by the note, and I don't think the note should have to say that he is going to use the dangerous weapon, no. And I've got a gun in my pocket to hand over your money.
But why should it be worse if he actually demonstrates a toy pistol, which that victim assumes and thinks is a real one? Why should that be something of a lesser degree than if he doesn't expose or exhibit anything at all?
Well, I think we can all agree here, but it's what the courts are going to say later, that this toy pistol just simply, he's only threatening with the toy pistol.
I think the criticism is well taken. I agree that I was trying to get at here was that he's threatening to use it, and not actually that it had to be in fact a dangerous weapon. But
this is what I
see the point. Yeah,
the debate is centering around the kind of weapon they're using.
Yeah,
and this is really not as I would understand it. Prescribe is the conduct,
right?
Yeah. Not the nature of the weapon. You're trying to prescribe where the man comes in and says, "I've got some way of harming you with a weapon." He doesn't say it. He uses it for this purpose, and the man discourages. This is what you're trying to prescribe. And this is why I'm wondering if the threatens to use, it's just that most immediate use. I don't know whether it's feasible in drafting to say that the man informs the victim that he intends to use upon him a dangerous weapon, or words to this effect. I mean, if this can be included in the commentary on it, which will make clear what you mean, or is it better to put the words in the statute itself, that's what you actually mean, is that it's where he informs the victim that I have available a dangerous weapon that I will use if you do not do as I say. And this is what you're trying to prescribe.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think also I'd have some concern in this. Apparently in Section 3 you're going to make a definite distinction between deadly weapon and dangerous weapon. And if you limit Section 2 to the threat of a dangerous weapon, I could foresee where a man can make the threat of a deadly weapon and not come under Section 2, become under third degree.
Yeah. That would be a lesser included weapon.
A greater included weapon.
I think that's a good point, Don.
Yes.